What's up, guys? Welcome back to the Founders Lounge. We have a good buddy of mine on the show today, Mr. Jonathan Wethington from Chef and Shack.
What's up, Doc?
You look lean, man.
Summer cut.
I was going to tell you that out there, but I was like, I'll save that.
I appreciate that.
Yeah.
You're going to make me blush.
Yeah, I see it. Your cheeks are getting rosy. So you, I'm going to get a little personal for a second, but you started doing HRT, right?
Yeah.
I've talked about that on here a lot.
Yeah, of course. Kind of like, changed my life. Yeah.
Using Gabe or somewhere else here in town?
Yeah, Gabe.
Gabe Prank?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's like the energy levels are unbelievable. I was just tired all the time. And then I started it and I don't know, it took maybe a month probably until I started really feeling it tick in. And then once it hit, man, it was like, it takes me so much longer to get tired doing anything, like literally anything, just day by day. I mean, I travel a lot, obviously. And so I always felt like that. Always felt like I had that travel lag every day, even when I didn't travel. It was like by 6:30 at night, I was done. But now, nah.
It's
energy
awesome,
levels,
man.
Better sleep at night. Yeah, I'm a huge fan. I tell everybody about it.
I think I've had easily a half a dozen guys in the last 2 or 3 weeks ask me about it. They always come to me and they're like, man, I'm working out this hard. I'm eating this much. I'm doing all of this. And I still feel like shit. First thing I ask them, have you had your blood work done? No, I don't even know what that is. I'm like, go do it. It will change. You will be a brand new human. Like, libido, energy, diet, everything will improve immediately overnight. Like, it's...
Well, I remember texting you and you putting us in a group conversation and, like, I mean, that, like, literally changed my life because I was getting into the back into the gym at that time after taking, like, 6 years off and, like, I'd kind of adjusted my diet a little bit and I wasn't seeing any initial results whatsoever and I was just fucking tired, just tired. And you're like, you asked me the same question.
Yeah. Cool, man.
Yeah.
Well, keep going, man. You look great.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, obviously today we're here to talk about Chef and Shack and to tell that kind of whole story. I was kind of hoping Matt could join you, but I know
his
schedule's
like
kind of...
at Jellystone this weekend with his kids. It's like a family campground out in the mountains.
Isn't that where Steve and Sarah are? Where is that? I've heard of that before.
I actually don't know the little town it's in, but that's where I know where he is.
Well,
yeah.
Well, cool. Well, obviously, you're the CEO of the company. We're very familiar with it here in Wilmington, but I know that a lot of people that are going to listen to this, they've never heard of Chef and Shack Oyster Bar.
Sure.
Awesome concept, guys. The food is incredible. I'm a little biased because I'm an oyster freak. I kind of...
Right.
It's kind of crazy because a decade ago, if you would have tried to get me to eat an oyster, I probably would have slapped you.
Right.
I'm like, get that slimy little fucker away from me. Right. I don't want it. And then, I don't know, for some reason, Yvonne and I went a couple times. I don't even remember where we, like, the whole thing changed. But I'm like, damn, these...
It's like sushi, right?
Well,
like,
when I found out you could do the horseradish with the sauce and everything,
yeah.
I think the first couple times I might have tried it when I was younger, it was like plain.
Right.
No. That's like chewing snot.
That's
like,
nah, man. You got to take training wheels. You got to go from, like, char-grilled into fried, into steamed, into raw. People get turned off by oysters because they go straight for raw when they're younger, and it tastes like snot. My dad used to say, I don't eat oysters because I feel like I have to cross my legs when I eat oysters. Yeah.
We'll just leave that one alone.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, cool, man. Well, let's just start with the beginning of it, like how you got in. First of all, tell your background, how you...
Yeah.
And then we'll get into Matt and Sean and the founders of the company and how the company came to be, because you guys are growing pretty good now.
Yeah, we're going in a nice clip, you know, slow and steady for us, trying to go into business and bring on franchise partners that are the right fit, that we've learned that kind of the hard way, the good way and the bad way over time, as you guys have too, and trying to bring in people to your system that, number one, believe in true hospitality, which for us is authenticity. That's a big part of who we are as a brand. And as far as my background is concerned, I'm not a founder of the brand. I help kind of found the franchising company and that franchising arm, but I'm not a founder of the brand. I've been kind of around the block. I went to college and grad school for stuff that's totally unrelated. You know, helped me critically think and read really long books. But outside of that, I just love working with people. I've been in customer service, so not on the restaurant side, but what I would consider customer service since I was 15. So this year will be 24 years on the customer service side, and just love the idea of making people happy. Love the idea of people having a great experience and experiencing a unique product. So I grew up in retail. That's how I grew up and cut my teeth and just being, you know, one of the kids you see on the floor at Blockbuster Video back in the day and Best Buy and all that stuff.
Those were fucking good times,
yeah,
man.
Yeah, great times, man.
And we're going there on a Saturday and
oh, my God.
Three boxes of Mike and Ike's and three movies and back of popcorn.
Yeah, yeah. And the store smelled terrible, but yeah. You didn't care.
Horrible.
Yeah, yeah. Right. So I grew up doing that stuff and then went off to grad school, thought I wanted a big boy job, went into my first job out of grad school was in a bank and I hated it. Like I immediately hated it and realized that's not what I wanted to do. I had no interest in it. I put my time in, I performed well. And then myself and Sean started a beach bar about 45 minutes north from here. And I had known Sean because when Shuck and Shack started in 2007, they opened the first location in Carolina Beach. When they were building it, I actually answered a Craigslist ad for a kayak guide. And I know that sounds, this is like a circuitous route to how I met them. And Sean called me like...
Did you just say circuitous?
Circuitous, yeah. You need to Google
that? Can
you
use that in a sentence?
Yes, sir. Sure. So going around the way, yeah, so... So Sean called me like the next morning. He's like, yeah, man, you've got the experience. I've done a lot of kayaking on the southern coast. And he's like, I'm looking for a kayak guide. Meet me tomorrow morning at 7 a.m. at the basin down at Fort Fisher, and we'll see if you work out. So we met him at 7 a.m. I met him at 7 a.m. And it was great. We connected right away. And like 2 weeks later, the season was about to kick up down in Carolina Beach. Remember, he's there. They hadn't even signed the lease, or they had signed the lease at the Shuck and Shack down there to start building it out. And he called me 2 weeks later. He's like, man, I've got this rental shop, and you're not going to believe this, but I just called my general manager stealing from me. Like, literally, I walked into his office, and I called him stealing. He was like, I don't know you at all, but you seem like a trustworthy guy. Do you want to manage the store for me? I was like, hell yeah, of course I do. Like, do I want to go to the beach all summer?
Yeah, really. Twist my arm.
And manage a rental shop and, you know, spend my time in the sand every day and in the water every day. Of course I do. So did that. Loved it immediately, the small business aspect of it, building the business, getting to know the clientele. So I ended up doing that for 3 summers while paying for grad school because I paid my own way through grad school. And Sean and I really connected, and then I met Matt that way too. And they were building the first Shuck and Shack. And then what I immediately saw there, I fell in love with Shuck and Shack as a fan first. I was a total fan. Just the authentic nature. Neither Matt or Sean have restaurant experience at all, like zero. But they knew how to treat people well, and they wanted to create a place literally that where their buddies could hang out, and it was a fun place to be. That's how Shuck and Shack started. People ask me all the time or Matt all the time, like, you know, did you have dreams of it growing to where it is? Like, fuck no. Like,
yeah,
we just wanted to open a place that was fun to hang out. And so that's kind of where it went. And
most of the good ones, that's how they start out.
Yeah, right. And it was just kind of this watering hole that happened to serve great food. And then it grew from there. And, you know, kind of back to my story, I was working other jobs and kind of unsatisfied because while I was good at my job, I was a number, like in every place I've ever worked. And always kind of had an entrepreneurial spirit my own. I started my first tutoring business in high school, and then it continued in college. That's actually what kind of kept me afloat in my year off between college and grad school, and did really well. And they started to build their second location in 2012. I helped them do that build out, and then I went to work for the North Face VF company, the outdoor company. Loved it. Great job. Love that company. Still love that company. Great company to work for. But I'd kind of realized that's not my long-term career path. I wanted to do something for myself or at least help people build something. And so they called me in February of 2014. Sean called me and said, hey, we're thinking about franchising. We don't know where you fit, but we think you fit. We don't know what we're going to be able to pay you. And you probably shouldn't move to Wilmington yet in case it doesn't work out. Do you want to do this? And I said, of course I do. And so I started working with them in July of 14. And at the time I was hired, I didn't even have a title. Like, they were just like, come help us. And so I did.
You were the third wheel.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's kind of what it felt like. No, I'm just kidding. It was great. So I came down and really helped them consolidate operations. I'd worked for multi-billion-dollar companies, right? And on the retail side. And so I just kind of translated some of that knowledge onto the restaurant side, trying to get succinct operations and making sure everything's in line? And can we make this not only authentic and a good representation of the brand, but can we make it repeatable? That's the most important part about, especially on the franchising side. Is it repeatable and is it profitable? And so I helped them with those things. I slept on Matt's couch for like a year. Like literally I didn't move. My wife was in the Raleigh area and I slept on his couch for a year. And I guess the rest is history.
Yeah. I never knew that. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
That part of your story, I guess we never really talked about that.
Yeah.
So they, you guys franchised in 2014. How many units are you at now?
19 units now. So it's been kind of a slow roll for us. We've grown at, you know, 2 to 3 units a year, which is a comfortable pace for us, because at that rate for us, it's a full service restaurant. It's expensive to open. You know, it's based in authentic hospitality and, you know, kind of wrapping it up into a present is like, we actually don't train, we don't have spiels in our restaurants. So like when you walk into any restaurant on earth, they're like, you know, how many people are here? Or like, are you here for lunch? Well, yeah, it's fucking 12:30. Of course I'm here for lunch.
Yeah, right.
Like I'm not here to take a fucking bath. Like, yeah, I'm going to eat here. And so we don't have spiels in our restaurant. So a lot of what we're doing is we're looking for personalities on the franchise side. So we're looking for franchisees who actually have a personality, who know how to speak with others, who can walk up, you know, if we were sitting at a restaurant table right here, who could walk up to this table and kind of figure out, you know, it's just two dudes just hanging out. Do you guys want beers? Like, that's the first question they should ask. It shouldn't be like, I don't give a shit about your fish special. Like, so we're looking for franchisees that really have that authentic nature of hospitality. It just takes longer. Those people in particular are fewer and further between. And then to take it another step, while those people are fewer and further between, those people that have the money and the ability to open a franchise are even fewer and further between. So it's just been a slower roll for us.
I get it, man. We go through the same struggle, different personalities, but yes, we deal with the same struggles. I think Everybody that gets in the franchise space does. Have you had any struggles with, like, you guys are an oyster bar, awesome concept. Have you had any struggles with putting like a Shuck and Shack oyster bar in the Midwest? I use the Midwest because I know you just opened one in Evansville,
right,
which is my hometown.
Yeah.
And I know the people there, on one hand, I could see, well, shit, man, we're not really exposed to this. This thing's going to be awesome. Like, people are going to flock there because
where are you getting your oysters?
Yeah, they're just not accustomed to it. They're not used to getting it. And then on the other hand, I could see it really scaring people. Because they don't know what it is. They're not used to it. So, I mean, have you guys struggled with that, putting that type of concept in areas where they're not?
I think there's an excitement to it. So the first crop of guests that you get, for instance, Naperville, Illinois, just outside of Chicago, we're still building Edwardsville, but Naperville, Illinois, just outside of Chicago, they're the first crop of people that show up as guests, customers in your restaurant are oyster fans. They're like, we know that you don't get them out of the river. Like, there's no such thing. Like, we know that you're flying them in from the coast. They're kept on ice. They're kept cold and all that stuff. So they already have that basic educational component, basic knowledge of seafood in particular. And so that's your first crop of guests. Your second crop of guests is people that are friends with them, right? So, you know, we used to eat oysters. We eat them once a year when we go to the beach. So that's kind of your second crop of guests. And then that third swath is the hardest to capture. And that's where educational component comes in. So whenever we're opening a store in the Midwest, or even as soon as like 4 hours inland, because once you go 4 hours inland, like when you go to the beach, it's a specific trip. Like it's a weekend trip or it's a week long vacation. So it doesn't even have to be in the Midwest. I mean, it could be, you know, in the Charlotte area. And you have to take this educational component for, this is how we source our seafood. This is why it's safe to eat oysters 365 days a year. This is what our safety protocols look like, all of those things. So it's a heavier educational component when we move further inland. You know, when you're on the coast, people on the coast are, I mean, I guess oysters and seafood is kind of ubiquitous. And so there's not as much of that, right? But once you go inland, you know, our social media presence, our, you know, not just for the guests, but our training changes. Our training changes for the average employee that's going to be working there, because 999 times out of 1,000, they've maybe never had an oyster, never, you know, certainly never worked at an oyster bar and are less familiar with seafood. The seafood they know is salmon at the steakhouse they worked at, and that's pretty much it, or shrimp, of course. So it's just a larger educational component. We found raving fans inland because we're bringing something to their community that quite literally has never been there.
Using that area specifically, obviously, I lived there for 30 years, grew up there. And the only thing that I can think of off the top of my head in 30 years that was ever close to that concept was Joe's Crab Shack.
Yeah.
But different environment. Different environment.
Yeah, we're a lot less corporate. You know, if you look at some of the basic menu items, we do crab legs, we do shrimp, we do fish sandwiches, all of those things, just like Joe's does. But we kind of take it a step further because we do specialize in oysters. It's in our name. And so that's a big part of what we're doing.
Yeah. I remember going there as a kid and you got the lobster bib.
Plastic bib. Yeah, yeah.
The lobster boil, what do they call those? The steam pots with all the thing in them.
And we do all those things. You know, I think there's like a natural association with Joe's Crab Shack for us because we hear that comparison all the time. Like when we go to a place where maybe the Joe's closed or whatever. It's like, oh, this place is like Joe's Crab Shack. And we're like, eh, well, kind of. Like, yeah, we both serve seafood, but that's kind of where the similarities end.
Do you guys see better results in a bigger market versus a small one? The reason that I ask that is because we do. And when I tell people that, they're a little baffled. They're like, are you kidding me? So, like, our major markets for us at Clean Eats, I don't want to say they don't do well. They absolutely do. But we see major results.
Secondary markets.
Yes.
Oh yeah, we kill it in secondary markets.
Yeah, it's weird. It's crazy how that
happens. Love it. Because you're closer to rooftops and bedrooms, and that's what we want. Like we're creating this kind of dive bar, authentic restaurant atmosphere where people will come a couple times a week. They may not eat both times they come, but they're gonna come for drinks because we're a full service bar too. And so we kill it. We crush in secondary markets. We do extremely well in secondary markets.
With a badass buddy,
Bloody Mary. Yeah. Award-winning. Yeah.
Did it win awards?
We won a bunch of awards here locally, and then we got kicked out of the contest for a few years.
How do you get kicked out of the Bloody Mary contest?
It's too fucking good. Yeah, we had to give other people a chance.
I'm sitting here looking at your website. You said 17 locations.
Yeah, several more under construction after that. Yeah. Yep.
Nice, man. Well, what talk about franchising in the future. I know we struggled during COVID. I think everybody did. That's a boring conversation to have. But right now, the current economic situation is super hard for us to grow in at the moment. Are you guys experiencing the
same thing? I mean, lending at, 10, 11% by the time you go prime plus whatever cut additional. Money's more expensive than it's ever been. People are more hesitant than they've ever been. And so we started seeing this even a couple of years ago where banks in general, I think you guys are like just a slightly different concept. So you don't necessarily get that stigma of being a restaurant. We're a full blown restaurant. And so we get that stigma and banks are in general just saying, yeah, of course we'll lend to you. Of course we'll give you, $600,000, but you better have $600,000 in the bank right now. So we're happy to give you that $600,000.
Right, like who doesn't?
But like, it's baffling to me. Like, well, no, that's not the point of a loan. Like we don't have $600,000. That's what we're asking for it. So, I mean, part of me understands it because of the failure rate, but there seems to be no, depending upon the bank that you work with, I will say that, there seems to be, some banks just don't have any sort of holistic approach whatsoever when you're giving them a business plan and saying, no, this is different than ABC Burger Joint or ABC Taco Stand or whatever it may be. Like, this actually has a corner in the market. Here's what the upside looks like for the business that we're bringing into the market. We don't have local competition. And then on the franchising side, you know how it is. Like, we work really hard on getting the lease rate as low as possible, getting favorable terms for our franchisees, making sure we're doing all the due diligence ahead of time. And so that business plan or that pro forma going to the bank is a lot more robust than you would see from just, Joe's Oyster Bar or whatever.
Totally hear it. I know one thing that I'm struggling with now, and people might listen to this and kind of like be stunned when I say this, but like one thing that we're struggling with at the moment, and I think I might have talked to you about this on the phone the other day, like I'm starting to battle with, is it even worth it to continue to grow at the moment?
Yeah.
Like, you know, you talk about, and I'm going to use restaurant lingo for a second, and I apologize, but when you talk about like an all-in project cost, like what's the total amount of investment it's going to cost to do this, like for us right now, that is getting to a point where I'm like, I'm battling with the integrity piece of it. And like, I wouldn't do this myself.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I literally would not do this.
Yeah.
To where the interest rate is so high, the investment is so high, and what I don't want to do, what my fear is continuing to sell these to people, them go to the bank and get an astronomical loan that they're going to be asshole deep in debt to a tall Indian for 3 years, not make any money, and then what happens is people don't underestimate a 10-year lease or a 10-year franchise commitment.
That's like another loan.
It is a lifetime. It is an eternity. 10 years is an astronomical amount of time. And so what happens is they put all this burden on their shoulders, and then in the first 3 years, they're like, man, I haven't made a dime out of this business. I'm in here 24/7. I'm busting my ass to try to get this thing off the ground. And like, that's a hard thing to do right now with, you know, we could go down a wormhole with how much marketing you have to put into it, the overhead and the labor and all of that stuff. It's a snowball effect. That is so hard to do right now. And then what's going to happen is those people are just going to get fed up and they're going to go, you know what, fuck it, I'm done. You know, and then not only that, they'll be filing bankruptcy. Your brand suffers. You know, it's kind of a domino effect. So like where we're at right now, I'm like, damn it, man, if it gets much worse, we're just going to stop.
It's tough.
No,
like,
literally,
it's
just like,
yeah, there's so much more overhead now than there even was 5 years ago. It's more expensive to open the business. It's harder to find good labor. People are just, I don't know, beat down with nervousness and anxiety over everything. I mean, just even personal mental health. Like, people are just realizing, like, I cannot do this anymore. I'm not going to put the time in anymore. I'm tired of working for nothing or working for less than I should be working. Like, I want things to get easier. And, like, on our side, as you know, like, at least for us, that's why we try to put in a ton of due diligence on the front end, not only in selecting the right candidate, but in property search. I have someone in property search right now who's been in property search in another month and a half will be a year. But that's okay, because we're not going to pay $60 a foot. Like, we're not going to do it. Let someone else do that, and then we'll take it as a second gen after they close. But we're just not going to do it. It's not, you know, I think me as a CEO, like, the fiduciary responsibility of that is, like, it keeps me up at night. That's what I think about. Like,
I battle with the same thing.
It's crazy, man.
To the point where some of our vendors get really upset with me, like our real estate guys. You know, there's some people that we've brought in as new owners who, like you said, they don't have a $500,000 net worth. They barely squeak by with the financials they have.
Yeah.
Enough for us to qualify them. Mm-hmm. You know, and the only reason that we did that was they got pre-approved through somebody like FranNet or, you know, like,
right, of course,
or FranFund. I'm sorry, I'm getting tongue tied, but like one of the lenders would already give them a pre-approval letter and say, yes, we'll loan against them, or somebody, this person will, or somebody, whatever. And but I see those people come through, and most of the time for us, I don't know how it is for you, but most of the time those people turn out to be killers.
They're our best ones. They're savages, man,
because when they get in, it's either shit or get. Like, they have no plan B. If they fail, they are filing bankruptcy.
They lose their house.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
And most of the time, those are the people that
absolutely,
they come out of the gate like a bat out of hell, and they are killers. Sometimes some of the ones that we struggle with are the people that come in and they're well capitalized. They're very well capitalized.
Yeah.
Their motivation is mediocre. They live off of a spreadsheet.
There's not a blood in the water mentality.
They want hard data
them.
Before they left foot gets
that's
in front
right.
of the right
that's
foot.
That's right. Yeah.
And they just struggle. They
yeah.
don't understand the hustle mentality. And then they get beat by those guys that, you know, were undercapitalized.
Yeah.
But my fear, getting back to the point, my fear is always putting those guys into one of those, what we call like a brand new build out,
mm-hmm.
you know, like
mm-hmm.
a prototype design. And, you know, sometimes our real estate guys get frustrated with me because, like, I'm like, guys, so-and-so, don't even drive them past the strip center. Don't even put them in a car and drive them by there. They're not going to be able to afford it.
Can't afford it. Yep.
And they get upset because it really handcuffs them and it limits them to what they can do. But, I mean, at the end of the day, I'm always telling people, I don't give a damn what's in that agreement. That agreement might say you have 12 months. Well, so what? You know what I mean? Like,
dude, I have a form letter on my computer that is an extension agreement.
Yeah.
And like all I'm literally doing, it's like, you know, sub out the date and I'm just typing in the new date. Here you go.
Yeah.
Here you go. Here you go. I'm not going to do it.
No, not in this world, man. Now I've always said I would do it if somebody just gave up. You know,
you have to be showing progress. Yeah. Yeah, of course. Effort, all of those things.
But I would rather them wait a year. Like you said, that person's been in there a year. I'd rather do that than we always say real estate's the one thing you can't fix.
No, you can't. You're not going to fall in love with it. That's the thing. Like if you don't, for us, especially on the full service side, you're not necessarily going to walk into a place immediately and get all of the feelings, but you should get some feelings. I should be able to walk into a place in like, anywhere in Atlanta, Georgia. I know Atlanta fairly well, but I should be able to walk into a place in Atlanta and say, yep, this could happen. This feels like it. Of course, we got to figure out parking. We got to figure out this. Where's the bar going? Where's the kitchen going? What's the build out cost? I'm doing all these numbers in my head while we're looking through it. But there is qualitative feel portion to it for us, especially for the franchisee, because they have to be able to walk in and say, I see it.
Sure.
You know, I can look at, I can see it. I can see a crowd here. And we talk about that all the time in property search, with them. And I don't feel like it's my job, nor do I want our real estate team playing this convincing game. Well, it doesn't have this, but look at this shiny object over here that it does have.
Right.
Like I want them coming in and we even talk about practical things with our franchisees and saying, okay, it's a bar. It's 1:30 at night. The plate glass window in the front of this store just broke. How far away do you live and how pissed are you going to be that you're going to have to drive down here and put up a piece of plywood at night? You're 45 minutes away, you're going to hate yourself every single minute getting here. If you're 15 minutes away, yes, you're still going to hate yourself, but that's 15 versus 45.
Sure.
And so we're talking about all the practical considerations when we're looking at locations, and that may mean waiting longer until something becomes available.
So I'm going to back up one step in that process, and you talked about finding the right owner. That process for us is one I still, after a decade, I still don't think we have right, and I could probably... You and I could probably plug any other founder, CEO, or franchise executive.
We could put a 1,000-unit executive here,
and they would
say
the
same
exact
thing.
Because sometimes when you get a person in and you approve them and you do all the due diligence, you look at their financials, all their background. I've even gone one step further, and brokers are really pissed at me. I feel like I'm like the black sheep of the franchise community. Like my name is probably like when people say it, they're like, that guy, man.
Yeah, don't send him a lead.
But we used to do a paper questionnaire where they would, or digital, whatever, they would get this thing emailed, and it would ask them 6 or 7 questions, the random cliche questions. And what started to happen, especially when we got into the broker networks, I'm winking.
I don't want to talk about it.
When we got into those, man, it started to get bad. Like the pool of people that were coming to us were bad. And so I went to our development partners and I was like, look, you know that questionnaire that you email me and with everybody's info on it? They're like, yeah. And I go, we're not approving anyone else unless that's a video. And they lost They lost their mind.
Of course.
And they were like, well, what? Like, you can't do that. And I'm like, the fuck I can't? Do not bring them to this building if they do not submit this video. And so we got questioned to death. Brokers were emailing me, man, why do you want to do this? People aren't going to agree to do this. And I'm like, okay, well, then if they're not going to agree to do...
If they can't make a
3-minute video on an iPhone,
right?
Then what are they... They're not going to run this concept.
Right.
I can tell you that
That's right.
And I said, this proves one thing. Number one, they'll follow directions to a T. Number two, if you can hold your phone out in front of you and do this... You can talk to customers face-to-face. You can have that.
You don't need a production team.
You can have a personal connection.
Right.
I know you can talk to customers.
That's exactly right.
And then, two, it gives me and Yvonne more face-to-face, sort of.
That's right.
With that person, because what would happen, anybody can come to a discovery day like you guys have them, too.
Absolutely.
anybody can come to those things and sell your story.
And say all the right things.
Anybody can. They can come put on a show.
Yeah, that's right.
It's kind of hard to hide that when you have to do it in a video first, and then you have to come here, and then we take it one step further. While they're here, we speed date.
We do the same thing.
And there's a reason that we do that.
Right.
So if you put the same person in five different rooms with five different people,
we'll start changing their story.
Yeah.
Yep.
See how many times
you
do
the exact
same
thing. Yeah, it's fascinating to me, just kind of the small changes and nuances you can make in getting people off their game, like bringing in someone. I mean, I remember several. We only approve between 50% of the people that come in for Discovery Day, and then of course you have attrition after that. So not everybody signs, obviously, when you approve them, but. I can remember specific cases of men and women coming in who, from a business standpoint, who were phenomenal, had brought in business plans with them, had been pre-approved, got the pre-approval letter. But the second you start that speed dating, we call it executive interviews, the second you start that speed dating and get them off their game a little bit, you start asking them questions outside of what's on that spreadsheet. You put them on the spot. Like, we'll ask questions like, your business starts failing. Your bank account is overdrawn. You can't make payroll. What are you doing? I mean, just that dry. Tell me what you're doing. And then, or we'll ask a question. It's 5 o'clock. I ask the question all the time. It's 5 o'clock on Friday. You just had a normal work day. Let's pretend you're not a franchisee yet in your current position. It's 5 o'clock on Friday, normal work day. You go into the parking lot, put your car in reverse, put it in drive. Where are you going? Because the answer is I'm going home and I don't want to talk to anyone. You're probably not going to be a great restaurant owner because 5 o'clock Friday is a go time.
Yes. Happy hour.
Yeah. You got to be able to go. You got to be able to talk to people. You have to want to be surrounded by others. And we consistently can throw people off. And then while we won't intentionally ask the same questions, sometimes we will ask the same questions because we do the speed dating thing too. And so I'll ask a question about what's happening when your business fails or, what about work-life balance? Do you believe in it? Because you're not going to have it for 2 years. How do you feel about that? And then someone in the next office over will ask the same thing, and they'll revise their answer. And then, of course, after the candidates leave, we talk to one another. Like, we'll go into the conference room. What did you ask? What did they say? What did you like? What did you not like? Of course, man. Yeah.
Cool. It's kind of funny. I think everybody kind of does something similar.
Right.
There's just some kind of nuances and tricks and things like that that I've figured out over the 10 years of doing this. I'm like, man, so this is the status quo. I'm going to do this.
Right.
And really throw people off. And they're like, what the fuck are you doing?
Right.
It's just kind of funny to see the reaction.
I mean, I tell candidates when they come in, I'm like, look, everyone that sits at this conference table is financially qualified. And from a nuts and bolts standpoint, from a quantitative standpoint, could open a restaurant. Everyone. I don't give a shit about that. Here's what I care about. Are your guests happy? Are they coming back? And are they telling others? And if you don't check one of those boxes, you're not going to be a franchisee. If you don't feel like you can't check one of those, like all three of those boxes, if it's an X next to any three of those things, because I don't get that feeling that you can satisfy all three of those things, it's just not going to happen for you. And so I think that catches people off guard because they think, oh, I've got $500,000 in cash in the bank or whatever. I'm already financially pre-approved. This is a market they want to go into because it says it on their website they want to go into. I don't give a shit. It doesn't matter. If we as a team, my team, doesn't feel like you're a great qualitative fit for our brand, it's just not going to happen.
Yeah. It's smart, man, because I've seen a lot of other franchisors and brands that are new-ish. You know, they get a little bit of momentum and they get three or four, maybe five, six units open. And then they start letting their guard down.
They outkick their coverage.
And they're like, man, we got momentum. Let's just keep selling it.
Yeah.
Let's just keep going.
Because they think they can make it up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then quality slips. Ownership slips. Next thing you know, they're 12 units deep and they're dying. And, you know, that I love that stat. I can't remember it off the top of my head. That there's like 7,000 franchise brands. And only like 2% of them reach 100 units.
Right, right.
It's crazy.
It's crazy.
That is nuts.
I know, it's wild. But it's believable. I mean, you attend any conference and you're like, I didn't even know that could be franchised.
Right.
Like, it's wild.
That's my favorite one.
Absolutely.
Is when you look at a brand and you're like, you franchised that thing. Like,
I didn't think one unit would make it. Right, yeah.
That's wild. Well, let's get back to Shuck and Shack, the brand, for just a second. And I mean, we could talk about the struggles that you have with ownership and franchisees, and I think every brand and every company struggles with the same thing when you get into franchising.
Yeah, of course.
It's going to be the same stereotypical, you can't make everybody happy. The decisions that you make isn't going to make Joe Blow over here happy, but so-and-so is going to love it because it's better for their market or whatever. I'm sure you guys deal with that.
Every day, of course. I think we have changed our internal culture within our brand, especially over the last post-COVID, I would say. It has changed a lot. And that before, we kind of took this old-school dictatorial approach with our franchisees and saying, look, this is what we're doing. Fall in line or get out. I don't care about how you feel. And at times, that was good. Like, let's be perfectly honest. At times, as a franchisor, you have to be that way. If it's a brand protection thing, like for you guys, for instance, like, you know, you're not going to bring in a product that, like, you're not going to start selling, like, Fun Dip in your stores, you know, a little powdery sugar stuff. Like, it doesn't make sense. Like, you wouldn't start selling, like confectionery sugar and candy and jelly beans and all this shit in your stores because it doesn't make sense. And so that's one of the things that you would put your foot down and say, we are not doing this. We are not doing this. This goes against brand standards. And if you do this, we will start talking about default with calls. However, there's a whole other section before you even get to that. I envision it as like, there's this wall that's the default wall, right? And there's this field in front of it. And you can walk all in that field, all you want. And there's plenty of things in that field that are things that you should avoid as long as you don't come close to that wall. And so, like, for instance, for us, it's, oh, we want to try this menu item. You know, that's the most common thing that we deal with is that, oh, I saw this at another restaurant nearby. I think we should do it. And our response is, why? Why would you do it? Here's where your sales were. Here's where your sales are. Here's what you're doing as far as growth-wise. I actually think you should do more of exactly what you are doing. Don't get caught in this new, just chasing the new. Because there's a reason they did that. Because they chased the new too. Because something's going wrong operationally. Not always, but sometimes. So why are you chasing this new? And so for us, it's, we've taken this, in that cultural change, we've taken this approach of, just tell us, okay? If you want to do something different, let us help you do that thing differently. So, you know, I don't know, steaks, hot dogs, whatever you want to do, don't do it without us. You're not going to do it without us. You have to tell us. You have to make us a part of that process and let us lead the charge.
Or do a test pilot or something.
Exactly. And that's the most prudent approach. And franchisees, it takes them a little bit of time to understand that what they're serving in their restaurants, we as a franchisor have to answer for. We do, because when we get a bad review, when we get, you know, something goes wrong with the health department or really anything, I mean, caloric count, anything like that, we have to answer for it on our side. There's very little recourse on the front line. So when someone reaches out to our corporate line and say, I got sick from a steak I ate in such and such location, we're like, we don't serve steaks. We're like, yeah, you do. Here's the receipt. And so we're like, oh God, no. We didn't know about it. We didn't see it on social media. It's something they just served as a special that they put on the chalkboard or whatever. We have to be a part of that process. And so that cultural change that we've tried to create and instill and teach and educate on is, let us be a part of that process. Let us help you. If that's one of your goals, as long as it fits within those brand rails, it doesn't approach that wall. As long as it fits within those brand standard guidelines, let us help you get there and do it correctly, so that it's not only executable for you, but it's repeatable for other franchise locations. Because if we tell you, yeah, run with it, do whatever you'd like, what do you think we have to tell this other person around the line? Because you're not going to keep your mouth shut about it. They're going to know.
Oh, yeah.
And so the first thing they're going to do is when person B comes to us, they're going to say, well, you let person A do it. Why can't I do it?
Yep.
But there's no...
Crazy how many times I've had those conversations.
It happens all the time.
I think finally, after we are very close to having 100 units open
that's
and operating.
Amazing. Amazing.
And I'm pretty sure, knock on wood, I'm fingers crossed, our new headquarters, our new restaurant will be number 100. I just think the universe, I don't know what, like, whatever, feels.
If I got to come work construction for you on the weekend to get you to 100 as your new, let's do that.
But what you said a second ago about having your old approach was kind of more dictatorial. I think I finally almost came damn near full circle. So, like, when we first started out, obviously, I couldn't act that way because I didn't know how to.
Sure. But,
I mean, my background came from construction, so I was used to, like, leading people and leading bigger groups of people.
Right.
So the experience was there, but I wasn't a restaurant guy. Didn't know shit about franchising when we started, obviously. And so we kind of, those first five or six, they're the ones that kind of helped lay the first few stepping stones. So the last thing I was going to do was be like, no, man, it's our way or the highway.
You learn a million lessons from those first.
We were kind of figuring it out together, right? And then as we continued to grow, we had to start like pulling back the reins on things that people wanted to do. And then it got to, no, it's my way or the highway. I don't give a damn what you think or what you want to do. That wasn't that good.
Like, right, right.
You could imagine the results you get from acting like that to almost now I'm kind of like, I'm kind of numb to the complaints and the
of course
the people that email in and they're not happy about this and that. I'm like, you have to talk to so-and-so. I'm not going to deal with that, you know? And sometimes I battle with that because I want to jump in and I want to fix it myself, but I've kind of had to learn to let the people that are responsible for handling that handle that and remove all of my emotion and not get pissed off at these owners, because it's a culture killer when you do, because then you start resenting them.
That's right.
To now, I think we finally got it molded and dialed in. Do you guys have an FAC, like an advisory
council?
It died
during COVID. It's being resurrected.
That was the best thing.
Yeah.
In the 10 years of our brand, the best decision we ever made was to put that in.
How many members do you have?
We have five.
Okay, cool. And that was the same for us.
We had a call just last night, and one of the things that came up on there, first we introduced three new members, so we rotate it all the time in Franchise Advisory Council.
Yep.
So it's like a group of owners that kind of give us feedback from the field. It gives the owners a voice when we do a test pilot for something.
It's a venue given by the franchisor, which is different from a franchise organization. Is it different from a franchise association, which would mean something created on the outside to not necessarily battle, but oftentimes that's what it becomes. The FAC is dictated and sponsored by the franchisor.
We've had very good luck with ours. It's been a godsend to have it. You know, and last night we had a really good call. I hate like meetings and phone calls. Like, you can see my attention. You've sat in many of them with me. You can see I'm like butterflies. Like, you'll lose me fast. But this call last night was an hour and a half, and I think I paid attention the whole hour and a half.
Good for you, man.
I was stunned. But one of the things that they voted on, I'm bringing it up because you were just talking about it, like the person that wants to sell steak, knowing you don't sell steak.
Sure.
Like, that conversation happened last night. So one of the things that's come up that people are wanting to do within our system is this whole new thing with allergies, which I know you guys probably deal with like shellfish.
Yeah, shellfish allergens all the time.
Stuff like that. Yep. Well, they were trying to bring up the argument that maybe we need to let customers tell us what their allergies are when they put orders online. And I'm like, guys, I don't think you understand the repercussions from a liability standpoint when you do that. You're opening up Pandora's box, and when you do that, you're not shutting it. You know what I mean? And I'm leaving a lot of details out.
You're making like an unscripted promise that things are going to be clean when it may not be clean.
Well, yeah, then I had to kind of explain. We've got two owners right now that are in lawsuits over allergies. That a customer came in, they ordered they had a peanut allergy. They ordered the fucking dirty Nana smoothie on our smoothie menu, which is all peanut butter. And then like 3 hours later, they're complaining that they went into an allergic reaction. And I'm like,
of course you did.
But we have allergy warnings all over everything. And I'm like, guys, this is why we do the things that we do. Like, I'm not doing this because I want to be an asshole and make you put a sticker on your counter
or make you
do a certain thing. Because of these reasons, it was just kind of wild.
It's
got
to be executable and repeatable.
Yeah.
And if it's not executable and repeatable, you shouldn't do it.
I agree.
Yeah.
Well, man, I love this conversation.
Yeah, it was awesome.
I think we could go down the franchising wormhole all day long. Maybe we could do it again.
Yeah.
But where can people find Shuck and Shack, the franchise business first? but then also like just to go visit a location.
Sure. So there's a link from our main website. If you're looking for the location nearest you, theshuckandshack.com. And then the franchise business is shuckandshackfranchise.com. And then we're primarily in the Carolinas, Georgia, Florida, Maryland, Illinois, Texas, and growing.
Awesome, man. Yeah. Well, thank you again, man.
Yeah, of course, man.
Guys, if you get the chance, go check these guys out. The concept is awesome. Their food is amazing. If you're a Bloody Mary fan, again, I keep touching on that. It's one of my favorites.
Award-winning.
Yeah. The lobster rolls aren't too bad.
Lobster rolls, excellent. Yeah, yeah.
Awesome, man. All right, guys, till next time.